much for being with us, Maureen. Please stay safe. Maureen El-Neil, Sudanese activist, joining us from Khartoum, Sudan. That does it for our show. Remember, wearing a mask is an act of love. I'm Amy Goodman. Sweetest of love, I found out, came upon me and I was so sick. Sweetest of love, guiding us through, came upon me and I was so
listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 19th annual Silverton MLK Observance on Monday, January 19th from 6 to 7 p.m., streaming online. Racial and social justice activist Ajama Umi will deliver a keynote presentation addressed, Does American Identity Equal White Supremacy? This MLK observance will also feature a Q&A session, songs, and readings. Again, that's the 19th annual Silverton MLK Observance on Monday, January 19th from 6 to 7 p.m., streaming online. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Ahmaud Arbery's killers will spend the rest of their lives in prison. Oregon hits another one-day COVID case record. And Thursday flooding wipes out roads and power for thousands of Oregonians. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, January 7th, 2022. I'm Josh Salem. All three men who were convicted in the murder of Ahmaud Arbery have been sentenced to life in prison. Travis and Gregory McMichael were sentenced to life in prison without possibility of parole. Their accomplice, William Bryan, was also sentenced to life in prison, but with the possibility of parole after 30 years. Before the verdict, the Arbery family called for the harshest possible punishment for the three men. The three were found guilty of murder, aggravated assault, false imprisonment, and criminal intent to commit a felony back in November. Oregon surpassed its one-day record of coronavirus cases again, and the record was just set yesterday. KBOO's Yasmin Kobanoglu has more from a press conference today.
Oregon broke its record for new daily COVID-19 cases on Thursday for a fourth day in a row. The Oregon Health Authority reported 7,615 new cases in its daily update on Thursday, the highest number of cases in a single day so far during the pandemic. Before the Omicron surge, the state's record for single-day cases was 3,200 in August of 2020. Since then, the number has more than doubled. Health officials in the state warn that cases and hospitalizations will likely continue to rise during the next several weeks. Here's Multnomah County Health Officer Dr. Jennifer Vines talking at a press conference yesterday about the Omicron surge.
So I suspect all of us are going to feel the squeeze of Omicron spreading quickly through our communities and people calling out sick. That's going to disrupt services. It's going to disrupt hospitals, childcare, businesses, public services as people stay home when they're sick, which is the right thing to do. But it means that we're all going to feel some strain around just the wave of illness that's going to pass through the community and effects on services that we're going to feel.
While Omicron appears to be more mild than other variants, it is much more contagious. Over the past week, Oregon has averaged about 4,000 cases per day, a 162% increase since last Thursday. In addition, nearly one-fourth of the state's reported COVID-19 tests are positive for the virus, with 23.3% of people testing positive. Hospitals also reported the biggest single-day uptick in weeks, with 588 people hospitalized statewide, a 12% increase since Wednesday. Currently, 95% of the state's staffed adult non-ICU beds are full. Here's Dr. Vines again, speaking about the virus's strain on the state's healthcare system.
Unfortunately, after several weeks of hospitals slowly going down after the Delta surge, we're just starting to see or hear about an uptick in hospitalizations of people. We can't say if those are Omicron related or still Delta. It's impossible to say exactly, but it is cause for concern given that our hospitals and health systems are already under intense strain. And by that, I mean EMS calls are up 40% over a usual average volume.
Unlike during past waves, the growth rate of Omicron cases has far outpaced its hospitalizations. However, local scientists estimate that roughly 1,600 coronavirus patients will be hospitalized statewide during the predicted peak in late January. Health officials in Oregon said COVID-19 vaccines and boosters are the best way to prevent severe illness and death. They also encourage people, especially those with risk factors for severe illness, to limit their contacts, not attend any unnecessary gatherings, and wear masks in public settings. Schools in Oregon are also having to deal with issues stemming from the Omicron variant. Officials with the Oregon Department of Education said this week that it's possible schools could move back to remote learning if there are too many COVID-19 cases. They recommend a pause to extracurricular activities. They say if schools continue to host extracurricular activities, they should expect rapid transmission of COVID-19 that could prevent students from being able to attend class in person due to isolation and quarantine periods. Oregon education and health leaders say schools should pause extracurricular activities or ensure use of masks, testing, and other mitigating measures. For children ages 12 and older, the Western States Scientific Review Workgroup has officially recommended a third Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine booster dose. The workgroup is made up of scientists from California, Nevada, Oregon, and Washington State. This comes after the U.S. Food and Drug Administration authorized the expanded use of the Pfizer booster shot, and the CDC affirmed those decisions on Wednesday. They also recommended shortening the time between the completion of the two-dose vaccine series and a booster dose to at least 5 months rather than 6. In addition, the review expands booster dose eligibility to certain immunocompromised children ages 5 to 11 years old. As hospitalizations continue to increase, the Oregon Health Authority has published new directions for hospitals in the state in the event they need to triage patients and decide who gets care when there aren't enough resources or beds available. The state health agency promised to release the guidelines by mid-January as part of its response to the surging Omicron variant. State health officials have warned that the Omicron surge has the potential to overwhelm Oregon's healthcare system that is already struggling. The new triage tool is based in part on updated standards published by Arizona, Massachusetts, and Washington State. The guidelines direct hospitals to rank patients by evaluating the likelihood of their short-term survival to hospital discharge. In the event of a tie between two patients who need the same resources, the person already receiving care would continue to get it, unless their condition had worsened. In ties between two patients with similar conditions presenting at the same time, the triage tool uses randomization to decide who gets care. Hospitals can only invoke crisis standards and use the triage tool after they have exhausted other options, like transferring patients elsewhere in the state and canceling non-emergency procedures. Hospitals are required to notify the state health authority when they are adopting crisis standards of care and must post the information for the public. In contrast with standards adopted by many other states, Oregon's guidelines do not prioritize any particular groups of people for life-saving care. For example, other states award more priority to those under 18, pregnant people, single parents, or healthcare workers. OHA Chief Medical Officer Dana Harganani said the triage tool is still an interim document and they are open to considering changes in the future. Harganani added that it was not appropriate for the agency to decide to prioritize any group without first having an adequate public process. She said, quote, "We really need to hear from healthcare providers, from Oregonians, about where they would value and prioritize those things for a future tool," end quote. OHA reviewed its previous crisis standards of care after the group Disability Rights Oregon filed a federal civil rights complaint alleging the standards discriminated against older people, people with disabilities, and people of color. The previous standards said that in an emergency, hospitals could categorically exclude some people from critical care, like those with certain stages of cancer and other serious illnesses. Harganani says the new tool, although developed quickly and without an extensive public process, takes into consideration the concerns raised by the disability rights community. Use of the new tool is not mandatory, and hospitals that have deployed their own crisis care triage guidelines, as long as they are consistent with state policy, as well as federal civil rights and anti-discrimination laws.
The Supreme Court heard arguments today on the legality of two workplace vaccine mandates put in place by the Biden administration. Its decision could have sweeping impacts on how the country responds to the ongoing coronavirus pandemic based on whether or not the mandates can go ahead. The first measure is directed at businesses with 100 or more employees. It imposes a vaccine or testing mandate on more than 84 million workers. The second measure requires healthcare workers in cities participating in Medicare and Medicaid to be vaccinated. This requirement affects more than 17 million employees. The Biden administration says the first measure would encourage 22 million more people to get vaccinated and would prevent a 250,000 hospitalizations. Opponents largely consist of Republican leaders, businesses, and religious groups. They say that Congress did not authorize the measures and that they are unnecessary and even counterproductive. The Biden administration says it has the authority to impose vaccine mandates, citing workplace safety and established health care law as precedent. The requirement aimed at large employers was issued by OSHA in November. Employers can offer non-vaccinated workers the option to get weekly COVID testing instead, though the businesses do not have to pay for those procedures. Employees with religious objections and those working from home are exempt. The second case, related to Medicare and Medicaid, is based on federal statutes saying that the administration has broad authority to impose rules for facilities receiving federal monies. This mandate faces a number of challenges from across the country. The United States Court of Appeals recently consolidated a number of challenges to the larger mandate, removing a previous block. Judge Jane Stranch stated, quote, "COVID-19 has continued to spread, mutate, kill, and block the safe return of American workers to their jobs," end quote. The Supreme Court has already upheld several state vaccine mandates. The current cases are slightly different, as they are focused on whether congressional authorization is needed for the president to impose the new requirements. All of the Supreme Court justices are fully vaccinated, including getting the COVID booster. Flooding that started Thursday morning has washed out roads in Oregon and Southwest Washington and left thousands without power. Portland General Electric estimates 12,000 customers are without power as of this morning. A landslide on I-84 closed a 50-mile stretch of highway from Troutdale to Hood River. A flash flood watch is in effect for the gorge. The combination of heavy rain, snowmelt, and strong winds washed out a large portion of Highway 47 between Claskeny and Vernania. Seaside School District canceled classes and activities Friday because of dangerous roads. Officials reminded residents across Oregon and Southwest Washington that if they encounter flooded roads, they should turn around, since flooded roads can easily wash cars away. Oregon House Speaker Tina Kotek will resign later this month to focus on her run for governor. Kotek is the longest-serving House Speaker in state history, and her departure will leave a power vacuum in the Capitol once the legislative session begins next month. Kotek is the leader of the majority Democrats, and many were reportedly shocked by her decision to resign. She says the decision is influenced by the fact that she cannot fundraise or campaign in the one-month special session. 2021 was the deadliest year on record for Portland homicides. The previous record was from 1987 with 66 murders. One, and the final tally stood at 90. The increase coincides with a rise in gun violence in general. The city had 1,200 shootings in 2021 versus fewer than 400 in 2019. Most Portland homicide victims were killed by guns. Many potential causes for the high homicide rate have been suggested, including police budget cuts, fewer police officers in general, overworked homicide detectives, and more gang violence. There is little doubt stresses associated with the COVID pandemic made things worse. Homicides increased nationally by about 30% from 2019 to 2020. But Portland dramatically outpaced that figure with an 83% rise. The homicide victims were disproportionately people of color, making up more than half the total. 38% of Portland homicide victims were black, even though only 8% of the population in Multnomah County identify as black. In 2021, Portland had more murders than several very large U.S. cities. It also reported well more than twice as many homicides as Seattle. Several novel ideas were implemented to stem the rising murder rate, including using traffic barrels to slow activity at known gun violence spots, and a directive from the mayor to police not to stop drivers for low-level traffic infractions. Data suggests these initiatives have not been effective. The majority of 2021 homicides remain unsolved. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines from fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sona Lee. Then, at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be rainy with an overnight low of 41 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be partly cloudy with a high of 47. Today in history, in 1610, Galileo Galilei makes his first observation of the four Galilean moons, Ganymede, Callisto, Io, and Europa. The quote of the day is from Serbian-American physicist and engineer Nikola Tesla, who died this day in 1943. Tesla said, quote, "Our virtues and our failings are inseparable, like force and matter. When they separate, man is no more." A new law will allow Oregon drivers to indicate on their driver's license if they are deaf or hard of hearing. For these drivers, routine traffic stops have never been straightforward. A stop that would normally be routine has the potential to escalate into violence when an officer is not aware that a driver is unable to understand what is being said. According to a survey by Dr. Denise Thew Hackett from Western Oregon University, over half of deaf and hard of hearing residents of Oregon report having difficulties communicating with police officers. A law passed on January 3rd of this month intends to curb some of the anxiety associated with traffic stops for people who are deaf or hard of hearing. Now, these residents can voluntarily add the International Symbol of Access for Hearing Loss to their driver license, driver permit, identification card, and vehicle registration. With this implemented, officers can be informed if a driver is deaf or hard of hearing before approaching the vehicle. The Oregon Department of Transportation says this service is part of their commitment to transportation safety. Deaf or hard of hearing individuals can voluntarily have this added to their driving information at any time by visiting DMV2U online service center on oregon.gov. President Biden called out former President Trump yesterday for his role in the January 6th, 2021 insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. With that story and more, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
He's not just a former president. He's a defeated former president. Defeated by a margin of over 7 million of your votes.
President Joe Biden marked the one-year anniversary of the attack on the Capitol by calling out former President Trump yesterday for fomenting anger over the election and rhetoric Democrats and some Republicans say spurred violence. Trump responded to Biden's speech, calling it, quote, political theater. Attorney General Merrick Garland said Thursday more than 725 people have been arrested and charged for actions related to the January 6th insurrection.
The actions we have taken thus far will not be our last. The Justice Department remains committed to holding all January 6th perpetrators at any level accountable under law.
Meanwhile, at a news conference, Republican Georgia Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene spoke about the plight of pretrial detainees allegedly involved in the attack last year.
No one is defending these people. They are languishing in jail. They're awaiting their trials. Many of their trials are much later on.
A Washington Post poll found 58% of Republicans don't accept Biden's election as legitimate. And Republican-led legislative chambers in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin continue to investigate alleged malfeasance in the 2020 election. The Supreme Court hears oral arguments today on the Biden administration's COVID-19 vaccine mandate for healthcare workers at facilities receiving federal funding. Indiana Republican Senator Mike Braun and many of his colleagues continue to oppose employer mandates.
That is the heavy hand of government. That is overreach. And that is when my phone started ringing off the hook.
Several former health advisors to the White House have published a series of op-eds in the Journal of the American Medical Association, calling on President Biden to adopt a new pandemic strategy that accepts living with the virus as the new normal. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
The president's focus and objective now is to save as many lives as possible, and we know what works.
The number of new COVID cases more than tripled over the past 2 weeks, shattering records, driven by the Omicron variant. Finally, lawyers for convicted sex trafficker Ghislaine Maxwell have asked a federal judge for a new trial after two jurors revealed they were survivors of sexual abuse. Maxwell faces up to 65 years in prison for helping Jeffrey Epstein recruit and sexually assault teenage girls. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Sault Ste. Marie Tribal Chairman Aaron Paymet fights back as he faces removal from office from the tribe's board of directors in an action he calls corrupt. And Navajo Nation leaders are moving forward with assistance payments for tribal members during the latest wave of COVID-19. With that story and more, it's Shirley Jihad with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Shirley Jihad, in for Antonia Gonzalez. Sault Ste. Marie Tribal Chairperson Aaron Paymet says he expects to be removed from office any day. His comments come on his own personal social media page, that after the tribe's board of directors this week censured him, alleging harassment and intimidation of employees, malicious public attacks, and violating tribal rules of professional conduct. The Sault News reports Paymet was urging the board to address a citation from the U.S. Commerce Department for commingling funds and for poor fiscal management. Recently, the board created a new commercial entity with authority to make tribal economic development decisions. Paymet calls the action by the board to censure him corrupt. He served as chairperson since 2014 and recently won re-election by a wide margin. He's also the recording secretary for the National Congress of American Indians. Leaders of the Navajo Nation have finalized a second wave of COVID-19 hardship assistance payments for tribal members. As Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports, they hope it will help alleviate some effects of the pandemic, which has hit the tribe especially hard.
Navajo President Jonathan Nez this week signed the resolution recently approved by the Navajo Nation Council. It devotes nearly $560 million that was allocated to the tribe from the Federal American Rescue Plan to provide $2,000 payments to enrolled adult tribal members and $600 for minors. It's designed to help with expenses like mortgage and rent, as well as groceries, fuel, utilities, firewood, and other essentials. Many tribal members and families have endured significant hardship during the pandemic, including including homelessness, grief, and financial trouble. At one point in the spring of 2020, the Navajo Nation had the highest per capita rate of new COVID-19 infections in the U.S. It's the second wave of hardship assistance payments for the tribe. In the middle of December, 7,500 checks remained unclaimed by tribal members who signed up for the program. They expired at the end of the year. In all, the Navajo Nation received more than $2 billion from the American Rescue Plan, which President Joe Biden signed into law last March. Navajo leaders have also approved a separate measure to provide additional payments of $300 for tribal members 60 years and older. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
An historic first in Seattle. Deborah Juarez has become the first Native American named as Seattle's City Council President. She was selected this week by a unanimous vote of the City Council members. Juarez is a member of the Blackfeet Nation. As City Council President, she sets the agenda and assigns legislation to committees. She represents District 5, covering North Seattle, and she first made history when she was initially elected in 2015, becoming the first Native American to serve in the Seattle City Council. In Albuquerque, New Mexico, a series of community meetings is being planned to determine how best to address the city's legacy related to Indian boarding schools. The conversations are mainly focusing on the cemetery used by the Albuquerque Indian School, which opened in 1881 and closed a century later in 1982. The building no longer exists. City and tribal leaders don't know if any human remains are still buried at the cemetery site, which is currently maintained by the City Parks Department. Scrutiny of the site increased following the discovery of human remains on the grounds of former residential schools in Canada. U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, herself a citizen of the Laguna Pueblo in New Mexico, has ordered investigations of all U.S. Indian boarding schools following the revelations in Canada. For National Native News, I'm Shirley Jihad.
Clean water advocates are applauding a new state law that ensures drinking water across New York will get comprehensive testing for dangerous toxic chemicals known as PFAS. Michaela Savitt reports.
A new law on the books in New York establishes the most comprehensive drinking water testing and notification program in the nation for PFAS, the substances also known as forever chemicals. Rob Hayes with Environmental Advocates New York says every water utility across the state will have to test for the nearly two dozen toxic chemicals on the state's first list of emerging contaminants. He says notifications will be sent to the public if unsafe levels are detected in drinking water.
New Yorkers are about to finally find out what's in their water and if they're being exposed to toxic PFAS chemicals. We're going to see testing hopefully starting this year, and then there will be regular testing happening for new contaminants every so often after that.
High exposure to PFAS chemicals has been found to negatively affect human health and the environment. Backers of the new law are urging the State Department of Health to set notification levels for low amounts of every emerging contaminant listed. Clean water advocacy groups have been pushing for transparency about toxic chemicals for more than 4 years. Mana Jo Green of Hudson River Sloop Clearwater says the legislation ties in with the new Green Amendment voters overwhelmingly passed on the November ballot.
It's an actual amendment to the New York State Constitution that guarantees the right to clean air, clean water, and a healthy environment. This is a specific way to implement and ensure those rights.
In recent years, New York has enacted several bills to eliminate the use of PFAS chemicals in products like firefighting foam and food packaging. Hayes hopes to see even more efforts to ban them in other products.
Because really, if we want to prevent water contamination, we have to stop these chemicals at the source. When we put them into products, they end up in our environment and they put public health at risk.
He notes a second list that includes 14 more chemicals as emerging contaminants will be published in coming years. Under the law, the New York Department of Health must update the list of emerging contaminants at least every 3 years. I'm Michaela Savitt for New York News Connection.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, January 7th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Caitlin Backus, and Yasmin Kobanoglu. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Nadia Ramlagan, Shirley Jihad, and Michaela Savin. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, at FAIR, we say you can change the channel all you want, but you can't turn on what isn't there. The loss of an information source, a particular place for debate, for conversation on issues relevant to you, well, that loss is incalculable. But very real. We talked about that and why we can still be hopeful with Craig Aaron of the group Free Press. Also on the show, fashion is always a huge media story, but what goes into it is not. The fashion industry is a prime driver of structure.